China and the History Department. And it is my honor and my pleasure to be here. It's my honor to be here because I was invited to chair a session that, you know, on topics that I'm entirely not familiar with. And it is my pleasure because we have a distinguished panel. We have here as our guest a friend, a good, very good friend, and a fellow student from our days at the History Department of UCLA many, many years ago. And it so affected me that, you know, Professor Issam Kleinberg was known as the person who was working on Heidegger and Levinas and Heidegger in France. So when I was right preparing the bio for today, I was saying, okay, his first book is on Heidegger and Levinas, and I forgot the title. Yeah. But we are here for the present book that came out. We are here to discuss the book, you know, Haunting History for a Deconstruction Approach, Deconstructive Approach to the Past, that just came out at Stanford, a felicitous event. We had an exchange about this book in the past hour. I have only a few words to say about things that really caught my eye before I will present the panelists and the speaker. And part of the book is speaking about, you know, the idea of, you know, the connection between presence and absence. And there's one sentence here that I will read very, very quickly. In presence, this positing is presented as a transhistorical transcendent portal through which meaning flows from the past to the present. Let me understand it on my own terms. So in a very, very personal terms, when you talk about presence and absence, I would like to, it invokes in me a very specific segment or a group of Palestinian refugees that have been declared in 1953 in Israeli law as present absentees. Uh-huh. Yes, and they do affect the present. It's a form of a past that informs the present to this day, you know, as a legal and of course as a political problem. The lost tribes of Israel, you know, that were exiled by the Assyrians or by the tribes in 721 BCE are also present absentees because we always wait for them to come back, you know, and everybody from the first temple Israelite Judeans, you know, until the Mormons of today, you know, is still looking for the lost tribes to come back, depending either as the Messiah or as the Apocalypse. The third instance that I want to invoke here is the idea, it connects to the idea of ghost that's also in the book. You know, the ghost is something that is present. So in the Chinese tradition, you know, when you die, you become a ghost. And you are very much part of the present. I mean, this is one of the most continuous cults, and very, very important, it's a very important holiday, you know, in Chinese religions, you know, about ghosts and about hungry ghosts that you have to appease. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about a book that came out in 86, Remembrances, The Experience of the Past in Classical Chinese Literature by Stephen Owen, in which he discusses the poet Du Fu, a very, very important Chinese poet from the early Tang period. And Du Fu, first of all, he loved a lot of wine. He was a very good poet, like everybody in the Tang period. But he had to live through a very, very calamitous period where the Chinese have a serious rebellion, the Anlushan Rebellion. They also lose to the Arab armies in the Battle of Talas in 751. And in an old age, in 770, he writes a poem which is called Meeting Li Guanyin in the Southland. This is just before he dies. And Stephen Owen analyzes the poem, and Li Guanyin is a figure that's from an earlier period when everything was great in the Tang Dynasty. And he says, Du Fu invokes his ghost and he meets his ghost in 770, after all 20 years of calamities. And Stephen Owen says, Li Guanyin is what Du Fu called Yu Wu, a remainder, something left over, not simply the singer who stands before them, but a reminder of what once was and of what the changes that have occurred in the world in the singer's circumstances. He stands before us and sings. Li Guanyin was a singer, framed by the ghost of the Kaiyuan era, which was a great period, a world of luxury and pleasure that was blind to the destruction coming upon it. Yes, just before all these calamities bang on the Tang Dynasty. I don't know if I made sense, yes, but I use this as an appetizer to what we're going to hear from the author of the book and from our panelists. I don't know your order, by the way. So
you decide on.
Okay, so maybe we'll go this way. Okay, so our first speaker will be Professor John Scott, who is a professor emerita from the Institute of Advanced Study. I'm particularly pleased also to have on our panel Professor Carol Gluck, a historian of Japan from Columbia University, and of course Professor Stefanos Gerolamos from NYU, our own department. So, before you,
yeah, well, okay, yes, yeah, sure. That would make sense. Although I could comment on my
phone. But isn't that what all the email says?
That is what the email said. So, an email tells us what to do, as we all know. So I guess the first thing I would do is thank all of you for coming, and thank Svi and Joan and Carol and Stefanos for being here and doing this. And I'm really honored, humbled, and a little scared by the whole ordeal because, Steph and I are longtime interlocutors and we've had lots of wonderful, both simpatico and ruffle tumble conversations. Carol and Joan, of course, are people who work I admire so much, and so then there's a lot invested in that. But as a result, I'm just basically incredibly pleased to be here and to be able to be part of this conversation. And I don't want to take up too much of the time because I think that it's better served to hear what the others have to say. But I guess to gain purchase on it, I'll say a couple words about the book itself, or as best I can in 7 to 10 minutes. And what I'm trying to achieve. The book itself is something of a quixotic intervention in and maybe even against the discipline of history as it's currently practiced. And really what I had hoped it would be, hope it will be, is a call to think differently about the way we do history and the way we think about the past at a moment where, to my mind, actually the possibilities and the means of both doing research and writing history are changing radically. And whether we want to hop on board with that or not, I think the intervention, well, to my mind, is warranted. It really is a movement against what I think is a strange dissonance that most conventional historians hold. Between a fairly sophisticated understanding that the past is a strange object that isn't there at all, it doesn't have any properties anymore that we could speak of, although remnants of it are here and there and they pop up, but then again, those are remnants of the past and the present. They aren't remnants of the past and the past. And yet, even though historians for the most part are aware and accept this, they operate in their work as if the past was something that could be retrieved and brought to us, not unlike this pen. And this is a phenomenon I refer to it as ontological realism. And what I mean by this is a belief that the past and past events are things that happened in a very specific way, have certain properties, and all of those can be retrieved and brought to the present if one has the appropriate epistemological or methodological tools at hand. Now, one of the things that's strange about this to me, well, I'll first say, you can imagine this in a weaker and stronger variant. The strong variant would be saying, oh yeah, well, the past is there, it's absolutely there, we can bring it back exactly as it happened. You know, I don't think many, if any, historians actually believe that. Mostly they believe, well, we can get to it more or less. There's, you know, slippages, there's problems of hermeneutics, there's problems of perspective, but the better our methodology, the better we can do it because it really was there in a certain way. And even though it's a very weak variant, I think there are aspects of the stronger that are still at play in the weaker. So one could then say, so what? Historians have this kind of approach to the past and it leads them to write realist narratives, and they've been doing that for a while. What does it matter? Well, I think it does matter because what's lost when you make these sort of one-to-one correlations is, first of all, a slippage between history and the past in which they kind of become corollaries to one another. When you're doing history, you're doing the past, which I don't think is right. But even perhaps more pernicious, you end up writing a sort of history and creating a kind of a map that you then you take the representation to be the original. Now, this is a sort of tautology, but the problem with it is that it creates a kind of strict pathway on which history can be written and what can be counted as history. And therefore, some types of narratives and some voices, because they're considered to be ontologically real, and thus the way in which we approach the past, become increasingly dominant. And later historians follow that pathway over and over again, and we lose the many other voices, possible past, possible histories that have been overwritten. And it's these overwritten pasts, these repressed pasts, these forgotten pasts, these, I think, are what I refer to as the ghosts that haunt history. And the ghosts that haunt history come back in all sorts of ways, often in absences in the dominant histories that have been written. And so what I'm asking us to do is to take what I call a ontological approach. And one could think of this ontologie, you know, in the French, the H disappears, and the ontologie and the ontologie seem to be the same. One is silently replaced by the other. And I think that's often what historians do. The spectral quality of the past, the presence and absence at play in the past, is replaced by this kind of ontological realist sense that it is something that's reified and actually there. I want to get back to the ontology of it. I want the historian to be attuned to the way the past, whatever that is, if it's an object, is a strange object. If it has an ontology, I would argue it has a latent ontology that is activated by the historian in the present. And so it's only parts of the past that are activated, and those are made legible. But here's where the deconstruction comes in. I want our writing of history, our research into history, to be attuned to the way that the making legible is also a making illegible. The way that the creating of a pathway is also the creating of a kind of restriction. And I use the terms poros and aporia here. You can imagine the past as a kind of large expanse of sea. And the poros is that root from the sea. The past is down below the ocean. We find our way by maybe there's an island, or there's a buoy, or there's a shipwreck, or something comes up. But largely what we do is we follow the wakes of ships that have come before us, to other historians. The problem with this approach is that, yes, it gets you from point A to point B on a poros, a pathway, but that poros itself becomes a kind of aporia when we no longer are willing to move off of it. In following the pathway each time the same way, we disregard the rest of the sea. We disregard the rest of the possible paths that are out there, and we restrict what we can do. And so I want us to be playing with this present and absent, with this poros and aporia, for the historian to be attuned of the way that each legibility is an illegibility. And that's why I think the ghost is such a good, I'm not even sure if it's a metaphor, but the ghost is such a good figure for us. The ghost is present and absent. The ghost is gone. It's a remainder of another time, and yet it really is here with us now. That's how the ghost works. And it's not comforting. So unlike ontological realism, where you make something solid and controlled and temporally simple, the ghost makes things complicated. It makes things uneasy. It makes things scary. And so if there's one thing that I want to do, it is almost Halloween, is to take this book and maybe scare historians a little bit and other people who think about the past to make them uncomfortable. And uncomfortable, I hope, in the end, in a productive way. But, of course, that remains to be seen.
Thank you so much.
So I think it is productive. And but you produced for me a number of questions as well as a really terrific engagement with the current practice of history. And when I was writing these notes, I didn't say the theory and practice of history, just the practice of history, because I think we're still in a moment when the death of theory has been triumphantly proclaimed, indeed celebrated, when many historians have turned with relief to accumulating the big data that you talk about here, or simply telling evidence-based stories about an unproblematic past. The self-reflexive moment, the epistemological challenge associated with names like Foucault, Irigaray, Derrida, Lacan, all those dangerous French theorists who integrated the very ground on which we stood, reality, truth, experience, language, the body, that moment is said to be past, a wrong turn taken. Thankfully, we're now on the right course. So your book, I think, haunts that triumphalism. Haunts is I deliberately said that, with a powerful critique of what you call ontological realism, which, and I'll read the quote, which you define as a commitment to history as an endeavor concerned with events assigned to a specific location in space and time that are in principle observable and as such are regarded as fixed and immutable. The historian may accept the idea that her understanding of those events is uncertain. There's nuance in this story, possibly constrained by her own subjectivity, but again, a quote, this is mitigated by the ontological certainty that the event happened in a certain way at a certain time. Ethan uses Derrida's notion of deconstruction to formulate his critique, which I think he defines beautifully as a reading practice that treats a text as a site of contestation and struggle, a site where meaning is produced, not reflected. And I was thinking if I taught courses anymore, that thing on page 15 where you define deconstruction would be something I'd assign to people. You don't need a whole long book explaining what deconstruction is. You got it in that paragraph. Deconstruction is for Ethan, the unsettling of received authority, a way of understanding the operations of that authority, its very construction, a way not only to revise what are taken to be authoritative accounts of the past, but to question the very premises on which those accounts rest. As you can tell, I'm sure, I think the book is terrific both in its ambition and its execution. And here comes the nonetheless, right? Nonetheless, there are points I wanted elaborated, places where I think still more thought is needed, and I'll just list them to open a conversation. So one question I had, and it became more urgent as I read further, was what will this philosophical exercise yield in practice? What would the kind of deconstructed history Ethan wants us to write look like? Is it really possible to write settled texts and unsettle them at the same time? I'm talking about the writing of our own texts, not those we're analyzing. Unsettling those texts is one thing, and that's easy. I mean, it's not easy, but it's indicated. But what about our own texts? Are there formal questions about narrative we need to engage? Are deconstruction and narration incompatible? Or is the narrative now about linguistic contestation and struggle? And isn't that linguistic contestation and struggle something also of an ontological, realistic presence? At the end of the very last chapter, Ethan gives us a hint of what he hopes to do, of what this will look like in practice, a book on Emmanuel Levinas's Talmudic lectures in Paris from 1960 to 1990. He will approach Levinas using Derrida's notion of la double séance, the double session. In the first session, Ethan will follow the path of what has become traditional intellectual history, contextualizing the author and his writing, asking how he creates and gains his intellectual authority. In the second session, he will read Levinas closely to show how the first approach, quote, discounts some fundamental aspects of Levinas's thought. By using Levinas's Talmudic readings as contextualized historical documents, this is still the quote, the first account dismisses Levinas's own counter-historical claim that divine and ethical meaning transcend time. So having historicized him, he's now going to say Levinas is arguing against historicization. Deconstruction, Ethan points out, exposes the limits of that first traditional approach, not only because it's incomplete, but also because it makes aspects of Levinas's thought illegible. But here we're on tricky ground. Does making the illegible legible, again, presume a certain ontological reality? Not, Kleinberg says, if we pursue, quote, an interminable analysis wherein the historical investigation turns on itself as the hierarchy is constantly reestablished, each undermining the definitive status of the other, end of quote. I think this is what I tried to do in my book, Only Paradoxes, to offer confounding the established reading of French feminist claims for equality as falling into either equality or different schools. But I also think I was operating with a sense of the reality of what deconstructing the opposition revealed. So it's that tricky notion of how to nuance enough the critique of ontological realism, I think. So that was one. So next, or second, I was confused about the difference between doing deconstructive history and deconstructive readings of other histories. When you talk about E.P. Thompson's The Making of the English Working Class, I think you rightly acknowledge Thompson's activation of, and this is a quote again, a latent ontology of a forgotten past. But you read the implications of that activation beyond what I think the book itself actually does. You say it shows that, quote, previous historical accounts had been haunted by the making of the English working class all along, as had works of literature and art, end of quote. But I wonder, does that make the book deconstructive history? I don't think so. I think yours is a deconstructive reading of the making of the English working class, but the making is not itself deconstructive history. As all those, and not only the making of the English working class, but like all of those efforts to rescue, to make legible, to make visible those who had been hidden from history, those also are not deconstructive histories. And I guess the question is, what's the difference between the kind of compensatory rescue of those forgotten by history and the kind of deconstructive history that you're looking to produce? Another question was about revision. On page 53, you say, quote, each time a historical event is revised, the very act of revision reveals the instability of historical truth, identity, and the possibility of recounting what actually happened, end of quote. At the same time, you note, and we all know, that disciplinary history as currently practiced has ways of avoiding this insight by attributing revision to the discovery of new archives, new sources of truth, by granting the possibility of new interpretive readings, even by tolerating the existence among historians of different ideological or theoretical approaches, Marxists, for example. So how exactly will our writing of deconstructive history avoid that recuperation as just another example of revisionist history? What critical edge is offered to escape that recuperation? One little small point, and then I'll come to my final one. On the issue of death, I think it would have been helpful to turn to Michel de Certeau's essays in the writing of history. He talks brilliantly about the historian's preoccupation with death, living in the land of the dead on the one hand, and wanting to deny death by bringing historical actors back to life on the other hand. That psychoanalytic insight he brings to this engagement with and the denial of death would give even more power, I think, to Derrida's archive fever, and more depth to your own rich discussions of haunting and ghosts. And while we're talking about theorists, I wonder how Foucault's History of the Present figures in your thinking. Not an ontological realist, but certainly a practitioner of critique, how is the Derridean critique different from the Foucauldian one, or is it? Finally, the main question I wanted to raise is a more personal one, personal from my side, not from yours. I found myself in your pages to be the object of some of the history you recount, particularly in your discussion of Lynn Hunt and Joyce Appleby's attempt to save history from the likes of fancy French theorists like me. Reading those pages again, or reading those pages, aroused all the fury I felt. All the objections that spilled out of me as I read what I think of still as a noxious work. In that sense, I've relived that history. And this is not the first occasion lately when I've been the object of an historical account, or when a history being recounted is one I've lived. Ken Burns' documentary on the Vietnam War is another example. I mean, that was my graduate school experience, was standing on the steps of the Wisconsin Union and denouncing the war in Vietnam. One of the things you say repeatedly in your book is that as historians, we're dealing with time and place where we've never been. And this is a quote, what is certain is that when we seek to engage with the past, we do so by going back to where we've never been. And another place you say, you talk about the indefinite status of the past, its hauntological presence of absence. So my question, and it's my last one, is what if we have been there?
Yeah.
What happens to ontological realism in in that case. How are we both the subjects and objects of our own histories, as historians especially? And maybe you'll tell me that only psychoanalysis and not deconstruction is the answer. Thank you for the provocation and for a really intelligent question.
Thank you so much.
Joan and I have some very similar things. I won't repeat, but I'll tell you what where we were overlapping. So I love this. To me, this is a book of ghost stories, and I just loved it. It's a great collection. I don't think I've read about a specter like this since I read the Communist Manifesto. But there are two kinds of ghosts, and it's interesting because the one ghost has already been talked about, the other ghost has been alluded to, but the first ghost is deconstruction itself, which Ethan says is haunting the houses of history. And this ghost, he says, and these are all words that he uses, inspires in historians fear, anxiety, menace, dread. You said it was more than uncomfortable. These are really uncanny. Uncanny actually is one of the better ones that he uses. But anyway, so this is, just think about it. Living in dread of Derrida. The people who live in dread of Derrida are defined, as you said, as ontological realists or often conventional historians. They're the same here. So those of you in this room, you know who you are. And Derrida is supposed to offer us a way out of this, a way out of our benighted conventional ontological realism, so that we can deal with multiple pasts, with polysemic, slippery pasts, with more possible pasts than are on that one road, that one poros you talked about. And they're supposed to be able to accommodate presence and absence. And so the first ghost is actually deconstruction. And that whole first chapter, which is a fantastic chapter, which details the whole history of American historiography since Hayden White, but mostly since the 80s, is really about this ghost of deconstruction that's haunting. And the second ghost, Ethan's already mentioned, which is actually the past. And you just talked about it as the absences, but sometimes you talk about it more as the past itself, the past as a revenant. It's uncanny, here's the unheimlich, as a ghostly trace and all of that. So what conventional historians or ontological realists do is they mistake that ghostly past for something real. That's what it means, something real and fixed. And then they seek to do what Joan says, is to go back where they've never been. That's what you mentioned. So they make a metaphysical error and an epistemological error. I mean, they are really benighted, okay? So you have those two ghosts, and they run through the book, and they're like locked in kind of a wraith-like embrace throughout, which is what makes the book so stimulating to read, actually, is because there's more than one kind of ghost at issue here. And it's really... God, I can't even use these words anymore. I was going to say it's really a meaningful experience to read this book, but you can't use the word meaning anymore, and you can't use the word experience anymore. So it was just a good read. It's beautifully written, and wonderful evocation of literary sources. I mean, whether it's Kafka's Chinese Wall with its gaps, or it's the Ghost of Christmas Past, Present, and Future, or the Headless Horseman, the haunting the Hudson Valley. They're wonderful ways of talking, of using those kinds of sources, which I actually think Ethan thinks gets him off the hook of using regular, ontologically, realistically tainted sources. But anyway, I'm a fan of that use, and I'll get to that in a minute. But anyway, it's a beautifully written book, and part of it is the way he uses sources like that. And the summary in the first chapter is so good that I actually have already sent it to my colleagues in Japan who don't understand what's wrong with American historians. And they always want to know what happened, you know. So it's a great summary, you know, and they will be very enlightened. They will still think that there's something strange about American historians, but that's different. Anyway, it's a terrific summary. And he goes right through all of this, you know, the linguistic... Well, he starts with Hayden White, and but he goes to the linguistic turn and then the cultural turn, and then... to get to the backlash of what the people I think of as the truth trio, because I hate that book too. And that is to say, you know, the Appleby, Jacob and Hunt, Hunt and Jacob book. I mean, telling the truth about history. They were going to do away with this altogether because they were going to tell us what the truth is, and they were going to tell us the truth. It's an
give us grades about it too.
Mm-hmm.
Give us grades about
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Well, I gave them grades big time already, and I wasn't read out the way you were, but then to this period after 9/11, when you talk about the past returning, and the account is good historically, but it also shows something else that's relevant actually to my Japanese colleagues, which is that the American historians collapsed, and you say this very nicely, collapsed postmodernism, post-structuralism, and deconstruction, and into what you call one two-headed beast, who is Foucault Derrida, which reminded me of what has happened in Japan for decades and decades, where there is a hyphenate in Japan, and it's not a beast, it's actually a god, and that hyphenate is Max Weber. Now, not Max Weber, Marx Weber. And if you ask a young Japanese university student, if you say to him, tell me about Marx Weber, they think they're talking about one person. Now, that's a true story. I was just about to say, the difference between the hyphenate Marx Weber in Japan and the two-headed beast Foucault Derrida is that Japanese scholars and students know their Marx and they know their Weber. And it's very clear as what you say, that the historians don't read Derrida. Mm-hmm. They do read Foucault, but they don't read Derrida. So they're collapsing this whole thing, and then they're in dread of it, right, in this. So it's not even an intelligent, reflexive critique. It's just slamming the door on the ghost, right? But the ghost got his fingers caught, and he's still here. Mm-hmm. So I commend the first chapter because that makes those things clear. But the other thing about the book in this terms of I would call this explanatory or explanation is that as a historian, Ethan is a terrific reader of Derrida. I mean, that's why you want to assign some of this stuff, because it's a terrific reader of Derrida, with not talking about text as literary text or, you know. And Derrida was obsessed by history, so it makes sense that a historian would read him that way. But I haven't seen this before. Actually, and that's another reason why I sent the chapter, all right, without asking your permission. Now, no one in this summary, except Joan Scott, I mean, you may have been in trouble with the truth trio, but here you're practically the only one who's not tarnished in this chapter.
No, there are others. Not really.
No, I mean, you know, I mean, even Hayden.
LaCapra is the other one.
Well, he's also criticized. Hayden White is also criticized. You're the only one that's not criticized. That's a textual, exegetical statement. So I'm glad you're here because I don't want to be one of the other people. Practically everybody, he really does show, including people you probably would be surprised to see there, like Bruno Latour, and the philosophers of presence. I mean, people like Frank Eggersmith, and my favorite, Elko Runia. I really like his work, and there's this chapter two, which excoriates them, for doing what? For smuggling the past back in as reality. And when you use the word smuggling, I was reminded that Elko Runia uses the word stowaway. He says the past is a stowaway in historical writings, that historians don't even realize that the past has stowed away. So and you're right, Elko Runia does think that that's real. I mean, that the past is present. Anyway, no one comes off except for Joan, so congratulations. So the whole book is an intervention, but it's also a bracing and, I think, very well argued philosophical polemic. And that's very good for the historian's soul. I mean, it's very good, partly because people, I think, say that theory has died or whatever. So, I mean, we live in, you edit the journal History and Theory, we live in the land of history without theory. So it's a terrific a book. And I only want to make 3 points, and some of them overlap, or the first one overlaps with Joan. So the first one has to do with the central goal of the book, and I'll call it The Dangers of a Single Story, which, of course, I stole from Chimamanda Adichie. But the dangers of a single story are what Ethan is trying to prevent by advocating the deconstructive practice of history. The chapter called The Analog Ceiling, he chastises or criticizes conventional historians, not only for misguided metaphysics and erroneous epistemology, but for the entire poetics of history writing. And here's where narrative comes in. Narrative, it's these linear narratives which wrap up the past neatly, close it off, as you say, to other possibilities and alternatives, all the rest of all the ocean waters that are around that narrow causeway. But it's not only the poetics and the narrative that are a problem. Ethan also cites the methods and the institutions, the sanctity of the archive. Very hard you are on Steedman, I must say.
I thought too hard. So did I. She's really ironic.
There you go. I felt the same way. But the point is that Ethan has a point in being pointed about these people, even if I also agree with that. But the point is that the sanctity of the archive, which, as we know, and Derrida has dealt with, the authority of quotation, the whole form of the printed book and printed article. So this is the analog ceiling. Now, it doesn't help that he's also telling us that historians are standing on the false floor of facts. So there we are, trapped, standing on the false floor of facts, hitting our heads against the analog ceiling. So these are, the problem here are all the trappings of modern history writing. It's not just the ontological realism. So he offers 2 ways out of the trap, and these are the way you could do a deconstructive approach to the past. And it's important, I think he says, approach to the past, not to history. All right, this is to the past. And he gives us 2 ways. The first is digital history. This is something Joan didn't mention. Now, Ethan's the first one, well, you did actually touch on it, because Ethan's the first one to admit that digital history hasn't reached its potential yet, because basically digital history has smuggled in, if you want, or walked in right across the border past the customs authorities with most of the empiricist, positivist, ontological, realist assumptions. They just call it, it's data, but now it's big data, which is what you mentioned. But it's the same sort of thing. And what Ethan is saying is that when digital history comes into its own, it will have the capacity, is I think what you're saying, to do things differently. And I agree with this. I agree on the possibilities of a nonlinear, associative kind of thinking, which is embodied in the links, when you link. When you link, you can associate. It's not linear. We already have in cyber fiction, we have these situations with alternative plot lines, variable endings, and things of that sort. The question now is, can history also be liberated in a similar way? And I'll just give you one anecdotal example, because I also have these high hopes for this. I don't know how many of you know the digital history site Valley of the Shadows. Does anybody know it? Well, it's one of the earliest ones, actually. It's 20 years old, I think, at least. It's from the University of Virginia originally. And the idea was that the Valley of the Shadows is the Valley of the Shenandoah. And there are two towns in that valley, and they are exactly the same. They each had 2 newspapers, one for each political party. They each had the exact same mix of agriculture and industry. They had the same, everything about them they're like 10 miles apart. They ended up on opposite sides of the Civil War. So the idea was that they would collect every possible thing, every possible datum, and they are documents, but every photo, they digitized every newspaper, all the maps, all the deeds, I mean, everything, letters of the soldiers, with completely, without any selection, everything they could find, they put on there. And they said, okay, now, there's no narrative, go where you want. It's actually amazing it's an amazing experience, because when you do start linking that way, you go and you, I won't go into the details, but it actually works until you start to write something down. And everybody who uses the Valley of the Shadows writes what? A narrative. Now, that narrative may be of a different possible past than the one that says, well, it was because of the industrial north and the agricultural south. I mean, not to be able to say that anymore after they deal with these communities. But the point is, they write the narratives. And so my question here is, assuming that historians can indeed approach the past with a deconstructive eye, and I think that's what you have done, at least with approaching the past historians, the work of historians, the question is, can historians tell the past in a way, and this reflects what you were saying, can they tell the past in a way that doesn't fall into the trap of fixity and authority and that narrow route? It's this recurrence to narrative that I'm questioning. Now, the second hope that Ethan gives us on the last two pages of the book, so keep reading, is the double gesture one. This is the one that Joan's already talked about the Ethan's work on Levinas, where you have two different approaches to Levinas, one secular and one kind of divine, if you like. I thought of Benjamin. I mean, Benjamin was perfect for that kind of thing. Well, let me give you Benjamin the secular. And the idea is that this is not a single approach. But my question is, aren't these just two stories instead of one? Mm-hmm. And wouldn't Adichie say that they're dangers of a double story? So what I'm asking is that enough deconstruction to meet the criteria that you articulate in the rest of the book? I mean, yes, it's not one, and yes, it's a different perspective, a different approach, but is it enough? That's what we have. Digital history in the future, once we've broken the analog ceiling, and then we have the double gesture. Not sure that that's going to do what you want us to do. All right. Second question, and more briefly, how American is it? I've already hinted at this. The account here is centered on U.S. historians, and it's a pretty persuasive account, as I said, of the past 30, 40 years. At the end of the book, maybe the very last page, and if I'd been your editor, I would have cut it. Mm. Yep, last page. It's well-intentioned. Well-intentioned. At the end of the book, Ethan suggests a double move again, one of these double sessions, to counter Eurocentrism in writing history of the world, the rest of the world, the non-Western world. And he suggests that if you used a double session, you might be able to, quote, take conventional Western historical strategies and put them in tension with, quote, regional understandings of history. Well, I'll say few historians, so I don't sound too absolute here, but there are very few historians in the non-Western countries that I know, and that's where I live most of my life, that would accept that statement. Indeed, they would be absolutely in high dudgeon at the Eurocentric condescension that they would read into that statement. I beg your pardon? Western historical strategies, they would say? What you're calling Western historical strategies are, in fact, modern historical strategies in most parts of the world. And just because Marx was a German writing in England about Western historical experience doesn't mean you're ever going to be able to take Marx away from the Indians or the Chinese or the Japanese. I mean, it's not like that. Marx and all the other things, including, by the way, ontological realism and other things, what you're calling Western historical strategies are modern historical strategies. So that has to go, because, you know, the idea that there's some sort of indigenous narrative waiting, his voice has been silenced by the Eurocentrists, is Eurocentric, that particular statement. But you can rescue your position simply by transposing a little bit, because it does work. I know it very well, how it works in Japan, where you can take say, for example, in Japanese history, you can take what you're calling Western historical, we'll call it modern historical tradition, which for most of the 20th century in Japan is Marxist, but there are other traditions as well, and you can juxtapose in tension with other approaches to the past. Very often they're ethnographic, and those ethnographers that are in tension with this modernist view of history are also themselves products of modernity. These are not people who grew out of the ground and are the same as they were 1,000 years ago. But you can do, they are two different approaches. And that does actually unsettle the modern historical narratives. So I think the suggestion can travel. You just have to, you have to realize that you can, that Western historical methods are no longer only Western. All right. So it's pretty American is my answer to that second question. All right. The third question, finally. And this is something I really am bothered by way before I read the book, and I actually thought you were going to answer it. And you did to some extent, but not enough, I think. And that is, why do we care about the ontological status of the past? Why do historians, and this goes way back beyond Cladenius, Droysen, and Diltai, who are the wonderful subjects of Chapter 3, it goes back as far as antiquity. Historians have always claimed that they've got that clear route back to the past. They've felt the need to assert the reality. They've always done that. Now, in most places across most millennia, the authority that they hanker for, they got from God or the cosmos or nature. I mean, they had one. And you, what you call theological historical, which is what Cladenius and Droysen had, and Diltai jettisoned, right? Mm-hmm. So, but we're post that. Most of us do not claim God or the transcendent or as our authority. We're post relativity in the physical world. We're post linguistic turn. We're post deconstruction. Why do we still insist on reality? Why can't we just take responsibility for our interpretations of the past without having to drag the real into it? And you, in the very last, when you talk about latent ontology, I said, oh my gosh, there he goes again, right? So why can't we let ontology go altogether? Why does it have to be latent ontology? I mean, what I'm saying is, why does that bother us as historians? What's at stake in suggesting that the past is more fixed than the present and, of course, more fixed than the future? Ethan says at one point that we seek fixity in the past because we miss it in the present. The trouble is that the historians have been agitating over this for so long that I'm not sure that would apply in all of the context. All right, the second part of this why do we care thing is why are we obsessed with truth, and not just the truth trio. Because the truth three are not the only ones who are obsessed with historical accounts being true. They have to be true in capital letters. They can't just be true in small letters. And here I would love to borrow from Ethan, who's got this wonderful thing, the past that is, only is has a bar through it. Mm-hmm. So the past that is and is not is present and absent. Well, how about truth with a bar through it? It seems again to be a need. And the example, I won't have time to go into it, but I've done a lot of work in recent years with the whole problematic between history and literature. Why do historians have a right to the historical truth, and everything that novelists write is a different kind of thing? It's not true. And when historical novelists try to write about history, the historians come down on their heads for inaccuracy or like it's with movies, the same thing, right? Historians novelists or filmmakers who mess with history, the historians are very quick to show where they diverge from the truth. So I want to know why are we obsessed with this kind of truth? And now Ethan could answer, because the book does, because we're in the trap of conventional historians and ontological realism. But it's much broader than that. I mean, it's the same reason why the reading public insists that the memoirs today be accurate and truthful. Not only can you not fake one, then take it out of print, but if they find you making things up, they will devalue the value. Now, what is that's not about? They're not. If they're ontological realists, they are lay ontological realists, which suggests to me that there is something about this need for truth that that keeps nagging at us. Now, at one point, Ethan says that history has replaced religion now in some ways as a supplier of meaning, which might be one of the reasons why we are hankering for truth, but I'm not sure it's that way either. So I'm asking all of you, and I don't have an answer to this, why we can't live with, and make even celebrate if you want, the past as a constantly moving target, with Diltai calls a process, right? And write history that does all it can to render the processes visible and doesn't get hung up on how close or accurate. Now, my bottom line, historians can't make things up. I'm not suggesting fiction in the archives, except in the Natalie Davis way. But I do ask this question about that being hung up on the reality of the past and being obsessed with the truth. And these are really big questions that are fun to think about, to think with, and they were all brought about because of the poltergeist in the ghost stories in this book. So I thank you very much.
So I'm going to start then from the truth, and as I was telling Carol before, I'm very happy that she wasn't bringing this up. Forgive me if I read for the better part of this. In Akutagawa Ryunosuke's classic short story, Yabu no Naka from 1922, translated as in a bamboo grove, we're introduced to a scene of rape and murder. A woodcutter, a priest, an old woman, and a bounty hunter tell us of the murdered body of a samurai slashed across the chest in a bamboo grove. Akutagawa introduces a dead samurai's wife and then a bandit. Offering testimony before the court, the bandit speaks first and confesses outright to the murder. You'll know the story if you've seen Rashomon. He lured the samurai into a grove and tied him up. And after raping the wife, he agreed to her demand that he either kill the samurai or kill himself, for she should not have her shame known to two living men. So he untied the samurai, they fought, and the bandit killed him. The wife testifies next, but claims that after she was defiled, the bandit left. The husband, still gagged, concurred silently that they should both die, so she stabbed him to death and then tried to kill herself, but she failed to kill herself. At any rate, the bandit had fled and did not kill, and the husband was not slashed with a sword, but stabbed with a dagger. The problem's kind of evident because both have confessed to the murder, the weapon is missing. And their accounts are incommensurable. For a moment, just a moment, the question that Paul Vane asks in defining the historian, in offering this really minimal definition of the historian, appears. Vane asks, this document tells me X. Can I trust that it does what it says it does? I really like that definition because it's really difficult and it brings in a question of judgment that could be kind of replicated across different domains. So who am I supposed to trust of these two speakers? But then lo and behold, the ghost of the murdered samurai comes out to speak, channeled by another old woman, a medium. Ethan has a number of ghosts in the book. Scrooge and the ghosts of Christmases past, present, and future are the ghosts of Washington Irving's Sleepy Hollow, which speaks in his very elegant rendition of the tale for the violent dispossession of Native Americans. But he has no ghost quite like this. This ghost immediately contradicts both confessions, declaring that the wife chose to leave with a bandit, provided that he should kill the samurai husband. The bandit refused to take upon himself her dishonor, and under the angry, watchful eyes of the husband, she fled into the forest. The bandit, says the ghost, did not kill him, but freed him and then fled. The ghost makes it clear that the samurai could not bear the triple dishonor of himself and being tied up, of his wife, and of the desire by his wife to have him killed, so he stabbed himself. And then in the very ending of the short story, the knife was then taken away, but he doesn't know who quite did it. The cool thing, of course, about the ghost is that it lies as well, and it lies very well. The body, for one, bears a slash wound, not a self-inflicted stab wound. But we don't have a single account that we can trust in this. The ghost has indeed disrupted the different versions, but it has done so without resolving the narrative tension, and on the contrary, it's become an unreliable narrator in turn. It has said things that are contradicted by at least two other characters, by the state of the body, and so on and so forth. It's obviously impossible, at any rate, that the bandit, the wife, and the samurai should have all killed the samurai. The story should be familiar because it is the basis of Kurosawa Akira's film Rashomon. And Rashomon, and Kurosawa straight up calls the ghost a liar by bringing back an ancillary character to retell a yet fourth version, now to us and the priest, and not to the court this time. Akutagawa simply leaves everything very ambiguous. And I really love that this ghost that tells lies, and this key undecidability. And I should state straight away that I'm really very partial to Ethan's project, and I very much love this book. I'm not going to say anything about the first chapter, which has been discussed already, and where Ethan, with a kind of magnificent impertinence, takes the discipline to task for the ridiculous and conservative tirade against Derrida that has been hallmarked in all the wink-wink corridor conversations about the evils of evil theory and the perdition that awaits any graduate student who fails to understand what real history really is. I still get those, by the way. You'd think that I'm immune to being to receiving this after multiple books on this stuff, and it's nevertheless not quite happening. There'll be always this, like, you don't really believe this, do you? So it has become increasingly essential to the discipline to manage epistemological and hermeneutic questions that cannot be negotiated either in an anti-theory manner or with the use of classical approaches. And indeed, deconstruction proves highly useful, in many ways still new, a whole 50 years after of grammatology. So I'm delighted in this line that Joan has also spoken here, given that only paradoxes to offer is the key work in deconstructive and also gender history, but in deconstructive history that we all sort of normally cite. I'm also very keen on the book Experimental Systeme und Epistemische Dinge, translated as Toward a History of Epistemic Things by the historian of science Hans-Jörg Reinberger, who showed the remarkable utility of deconstruction for an understanding of experimental protocols of and lab things, things in the lab, and the way in which temporality and historicity become essential in the quote-unquote discovery of mRNA and in the process of synthesizing proteins in the test tube. It does very much something that Ethan sets the stage for. It does it a little early. But like Joan elsewhere, and like many others who have tried it, Ethan goes a step further here into a thorough reconceptualization of how history is and is not, or better still, what it is without a bar across it, carrying both presence and absence into the work of the historian. That sense alone can justify the project that, as Ethan writes, like Kafka's Great Wall of China, the past is and is not, or better yet, it is crossed out. The past comes and goes, and the pieces we do have are shot through with a non-synchronicity of prior historical tellings. The past is there, and with a bar, and it is also constructed, and we do get entangled with it when we do history. Now, this can take quite some unpacking, but I think you've heard quite enough to see where we are, that the main target of the book is this ontological realism, a sense that the past exists tout court, that it has ontological value, that is a given, that in a historian's historicism, we can distinguish ourselves from it and record and rework it with ease and direction, or that to push things further, we can make or remake it present at will and without further ado. On page 2, that he used this term, Ethan writes, quote, "But the past itself has no ontological properties. Or if it does, it has a latent ontology. Thus, the past event cannot be made present. Any reappearance is the ultimate, untimely visitation of a ghost. This peculiar latent ontology of the past, directed across the trope of hauntology, the haunting quality of elements of this past that are not easily captured, remain and undercut the easy pretense to a standpoint for the historian. That's a key argument here. In the closing pages of the book, Ethan further argues in favor of a narrative that accommodates an understanding of the past as something that is, cross out, as present and absent at the same time, as something and nothing, entangled in a seemingly impossible way, where the iterative position of the historian is woven into the past and the present, such that it also presses into the future. And just as this is the case for us now, end quote, and just as this is the case for us now, so it was within the field of our study. The moments that we treat as present and in which we home in carry both a presence under erasure, an unclear instability, and pasts and futures of their own that qualify and alter the moments or movements or events or periods under discussion. And so it is here that Derrida comes off as supremely helpful, precisely because the schema of difference with an A, as Derrida set it up to challenge ideas about identity, continuity, and structure, can be recalibrated toward new ends. Particularly this reworking of stability, reality, the supposed ontology of the past. Difference with an A worked by way of repetition, reiteration, which already inscribe difference within the process of repetition. That is to say, every time that you repeat something, or every time that you repeat something, difference is inscribed in it. If I say yes, yes, I haven't simply said yes. Or every time that I set up difference, as such, I'm already setting up a temporality insofar as you couldn't really imagine difference in a thoroughly formal or static form. But more importantly, instead of a movement of something given through time, we are confronted with difference as a mechanism for producing historical moments. A mechanism in which difference, movement, repetition, stabilization are themselves unstable and overbearing apparatuses and targets of our study. And I really found this the most useful part of the book and really the most wonderful use of Derrida here. He says, "Différence," this is Ethan, quote, "Différence avoids positing an origin, beginning, or foundation, replacing these with a logic of deferral and difference and displacement that refuses to present a definitive statement of mastery. This is certainly a dangerous proposition for the historian in fear of losing his or her grip on the past. But it is also a liberating movement in accounting for revision, unaccounted voices, repressed histories, and the proposition that our constantly moving position or standpoint within a historical moment conditions and informs our understanding of the past and thus of history." I should just repeat that last little bit. "It is also a liberating movement in accounting for revision, unaccounted voices, repressed histories, and the proposition that our constantly moving position or standpoint within a historical moment conditions and informs our understanding of the past and thus of history." Finally, I'm quite taken with two points. One where Ethan speaks of the way in which origins are constructed by using différence. If différence is supposed to deny an actual origin, Ethan suggests that the interesting part of this is that origins are constructed in the present by a historian working in the present and imputed backwards to reapply to past moment whose own past are not necessarily coincident with this scenario. As someone working on the modern obsession with prehistory, I'm really quite warm to this version of suggesting how it is that we are all too happy to come up with, say, the development of agrarian societies and urban scenarios as the utter beginning of a state that is always and forever harmed wherever it is that we are supposed to stand. Sorry, James Scott. Finally, I'm quite taken with Ethan's account of how deconstruction helps us think in a media age. Though here the joke and the news and the joke are probably more for historians than anyone else. The constructive approach allows for a movement away from a paradigm that praises the value of supposed deep attention and toward one that looks at multiplicity and otherness. Quote, "This is a polysemic logic of alterity that embraces and accepts difference. The singular logic of deep attention correlates to the ontological realist approach to history, whereas the polysemic logic of hyperattention..." Greeks. "Whereas the polysemic logic," I'm still in the quote, "of hyperattention correlates to the deconstructive one." I actually quite like this scenario, that somehow we are expected, or we should be expected, to think in a mixture of polysemia and multimedia possibilities that block this pretense that a deep attention is going to get us much further than where we were. But I'm going to pause at this point. As a matter of fact, I wonder whether you couldn't actually use this moment about contemporary media conditions and move backwards and suggest that it actually never was. The ontological realist pretense of deep attention never quite offered something in this, and instead this polysemic hyperattention is a good reason. So I have three questions that I want to move to at this point. I suppose that like Joan, and in a different way like Carol, I want, for one, a properly historical example here, so to speak. The examples that Ethan uses are largely literary, and I wonder whether this doesn't in fact defeat a point that you're making in the book. If we're faced with a multiple of similar articulations, for example, at a particular moment, specific expressions of a concept or of relations between different actors, how do we go about it in a decidedly different manner than we did before? Is it a matter of an attitude or an approach, an epistemological attunement or epistemological style? Is it, to ask more harshly, ultimately restricted to conceptual history and related fields? I suppose I'm asking in part because of my interest in history of science and medicine, on which more in a second. But the question is often raised to in what ways particular methodological cares and attunements then translate into overall actual direct work. And I wanted to give you a chance to, I don't know, even just lift an example from somewhere and play it differently. Yeah. Second, I'm quite curious about the dominant figure of the ghost and about whether it's sufficient. Now, I ask this because, in a sense, while disrupting the traditional categories of past, present, and future, while inserting multiple pasts and presents and futures within each past, the ghost then kind of stops there. The spectral is directly what is and is not here thanks to the past. What has not properly accumulated but hasn't vanished, it remains ghostly, so to speak. It hasn't receded either. It comes and goes and always returns. And Derrida speaks of le revenant, the sort of endless return. In some cases, I'm thinking, for example, of Natasha Wheatley's recent essay on spectral regal personality in international law, in interwar international law, where what is at stake is the existence and inexistence of particular units, for example, non-state actors as proper subjects. The proximity is quite evident, though she uses not only ghosts, but other figures as well. I could ask about Andreas Killen's Homo Cinematicus, where the history of medical film is shaped by collapsed German political institutions, the unstable status of medicine and psychiatry that need evidence, and the ghostly power of cinema in parallel, and these are not quite the same forms, let's say. Or I could ask about cases of concepts too, especially minor phantom concepts such as transparency, which I write about, where this is really very relevant as a ghost. We can imagine things surviving as ghosts all around, and of concepts as ghosts, metaphors as ghosts that are sort of there and ready to be brought back in, or that operate even in their absence. And we could expand from there to studies of Grundbegriffe, or foundational concepts, as though such concepts actually ever existed, where we could suggest that concepts such as the state or the people operate with a much stronger spectral quality than a real one, even though historians, including Koselleck, whom you don't quite target enough, so to speak, act as though these are real things, really there, givens. I can see how this is so useful for directions like this. But I wondered about something else. A hauntology proper should include all sorts of other beasts and monsters and poltergeists and zombies and furies and Godzillas and, you know, Zvi's present absence and nightmares and things, as in that highly mimetic Lamarckian thing that John Carpenter turned into a film. I wonder if such a bestiary or a cabin in the woods, if you will, wouldn't push much further, because there, the disruption of the past, present, future is not mere disruption, but much more far-reaching, a kind of explosion of these historical terms that still puts them in question without remaining simply fantasy or literary, not any more in any case than the ghost is. Zombies are not ghosts, and ghosts are not demons, and they're not sewer clowns. Zombies, for one, do not appear in the singular. They're several wolves, so to speak, and not one. They're static and coagulated and formed into quasi-animality, into pure desire. They bleed out into a perennial state of emergency enforced by sameness of the violent desire that they are. And I wonder if deconstruction doesn't allow us that kind of an explosion of historical time as well. That is to say, one in which the singularity and haunting effect, affected by the ghost does not, in fact, reestablish a certain continuity of pretension and retention, a perennial ruin and remnant of futures past that refuse to go away. I ask because, for example, in a history of patienthood, which I'm very interested in, the form of a past usually appears in terms of a health that is remembered by a patient and refuses to die. The health refuses to die. A patient who often dreams of a status quo ante before the disease. And yet here, the figure of that past and the disruption that causes the present, the disease, these are perhaps better followed by way not simply of a haunting, but of a mutation, a becoming beast of sorts, that are indeed appropriate to a genre of horror. They're not simply matters of horror, though. At the same time as we get fearful patients who recognize, in a sense, not necessarily their monstrosity, but their, let's say, fallen status vis-a-vis the earlier forms of health, we also get biologists and neuroscientists and doctors in cases, neuroscientists especially, who produce over and over new versions of the self, the hormonal self, the homeostatic self, the neuronal man, the neuroplastic man, the neurochemical man, all of these zombies. Well, that's what came to mind in a way, that we're speaking at the same time of these very peculiar constructions that are both conceptual constructions and very real forms in which a certain biology is transformed, and they're not quite ghosts alone. And yet all of these coexist at the same time and in ways that are not quite anticipated. And I wondered if the ghost is all there is, especially with a deconstructive approach to the past. Or what would be lost to opening up to such a different or more conflictual and more unstable and troubled scenario where we don't know what past, present, and future are at this. What happens to temporality once we push past that particular point and start playing with weirder figures as well? This leads to question 2B. I'm particularly interested, for example, in this, and it's within the same picture, in the relative marginality of Freud in the book. That is to say, the relative evasion of a concept of repression. And I would like to ask you to talk a little bit more about this, because partly in line with Joan's presentation from a few years ago on the impossibility of, or failure of psychohistory, I'm very curious what it would mean for Derrida to largely replace Freud. And three, I want to return to the dead samurai and to the ghost that lies. I'm really curious about this epistemological problem. And I wonder whether the ghost that lies doesn't actually hide a little bit in this book as well, as a kind of promise, so to speak, that it's better for a historian to be lied to by a ghost, I guess, than by the documents that are supposedly literally there, that pretend to be real and at the same time leave so much out. Perhaps this too is related to questions of zombies and bodies. How about lying? How do we not go back to a language of unreality and myth when we speak of lies and ghosts, and a language of truth that a ghost perhaps too should speak? What about forms of historical judgment, as in Paul Vane's question? To what degree do we also need to rework concepts like judgment in that scenario? At any rate, these questions are all to play on the stage that you set up for us. And if Akutagawa leaves us with a question of who pulls the knife out of the corpse, if the lie were actually truth, the knife that isn't, from a body that won't return, that honor here quite goes to you to pull out that knife. So this is an amazing meditation, and I'm really most grateful for you to be bringing it to us. Thank you.
Great.
So what, this seminar is going to be, what, 3 hours, 4 hours long?
Get going.
Yeah. I suggest we give you time to respond.
Yeah, I'll try to say something.
Yeah, and then we'll open the floor to... I'm a very bad chair, so moderators, please make sure that I really understand that you are trying to ask a question or make a comment.
So this is fantastic, more than one could ever hope for, and so I'm super appreciative of the engagement, and stimulating for me. There's nothing better than to be forced to sort of rethink and rework. I don't know that I can do justice to everything, but I guess I'll try to scroll through some and do my best, and we'll see how it all comes to pass. And I'll try and start with Joan's questions, although I think I'll address some of Carol's maybe along the way, or at least touch upon them. So the first question that was asked, and I think was repeated in one form or another, was ultimately, what will philosophical exercise yield in practice? And of course, there's some subsidiaries to this as to whether or not, in fact, in trying to proffer a solution, I'm not reifying the ontological realism that I'm precisely trying to escape. And I think this is a problem always for the historian in trying to make the illegible legible. And there are strategies for doing it, but it's fraught. But I think in some ways the answer to this question also is the answer to the other two questions that Joan offered, two of the questions Joan offered, one having to do with E.B. Thompson, and the other having to do with revision, because I'll turn to that and I'll circle back the other. I completely agree. I don't think E.P. Thompson did anything like a deconstructive history. I think, or what I'm trying to say, is that what E.P. Thompson did is what happens when certain aspects of the past that weren't legible are made legible, which I think you can do by all sorts of conventional strategies. But the reason I use Thompson is because he's an interesting case in which he was able to make things legible that hadn't been seen, the working class now as a viable historical actor. But in doing so, there's no methodological innovation, and there is still these beliefs in terms of forging a pathway that's going to be the legible pathway. And as a result, there's all sorts of actors and possibilities that are completely suppressed. And the one I use in the book is that Thompson simply can't imagine that women could be part of this working class. They remain illegible. And that's what I would call a truncated deconstruction, where what happens, and I think this often happens in revision and also in poor rhetorical deployments of deconstruction, you place another actor or actant onto the top of the hierarchy, but then you freeze there. And so what you end up doing is reinscribing precisely the logic, in this case of ontological realism or a certain kind of essentialist hierarchy, without ever destabilizing it again. I think in revision, what you get is a moment where you can see that the historical narrative or what we take to be the truth is no such thing. And we all go, oh, well, but then as you say, I'm using this sort of ideal type, but it's almost always the case that then that is taken again as a definitive conclusion. Well, we used to believe that. Now we know this is so until we decide we don't believe it again. In each of these cases, I don't see a deconstruction in practice. But what I would say is that, to my mind, the deployment of the strategy is successful when what one can see, and this requires a certain sort of recalibration of the telling, is that the one narrative inscription is going to be destabilized by the other, in which not only can one see the limitations of one approach by another approach, but also one can see the way in which some of the assumptions of the second approach are at work in the first, and some of the assumptions of the first are at work in the second. That's a sort of complete deconstruction because it never allows either of them to rest. And then you don't have anything like an ontological realism. What you have is a process. And that's the way the process is demonstrated within the narrative telling. And so that's the aspiration. Now, whether one can do it, of course, it's a difficult rhetorical task. And we would be asking historians to train certainly in a different way, both in looking at their material and then deploying their material. I'm optimistic about the digital possibilities of this. Joan also mentioned the question of death in Desserteau, and certainly I think this is warranted and important. In some ways, I found myself in a laser-like focus grappling with this, I think even within, what's budgeted within what I'm trying to argue is you work in a field and you're going to necessarily leave things out. The idea is whether I closed off the possibility of Desserteau for this sort of work, which I hope I wouldn't, because then that would be a problem. But the idea that, of course, then moving in either in a psychoanalytic in a psychoanalytic framework should in fact open up a certain other valence possibility that would be accommodated within this logic, or if it can be called that. Now, how Foucault and Derrida relate to each other, that's a big one. Honestly, I think this notion of a history of the present is absolutely attuned to what I'm trying to do. I think much of what I think a deconstructive approach does is place the problem always squarely in the present and is aware of this. To be honest, the reason I didn't get into the trying to address Foucault is because in some ways Foucault has been used, appropriated, and maybe even tamed by historians. I went to more of a third rail for effect, honestly. And then I guess the last part on this one, which is fascinating, is this idea of what happens when you become the subject of your own history.
There.
Right, but have you, I mean, yes, you've been there, but now you're going back, you know, so from here to going there, that's where the conundrums start to happen, right? You're now going back from where you are now to where you weren't there as you were now.
Right.
And that's the bar. The bar, it's not that it wasn't there or you weren't there, but the bar has to do with this entanglement and restriction. And this sort of, so you got this ontological, epistemological entanglement of the historian with whatever this object is. And of course, these problems of access. But of course, all along realizing there is a sort of reality, whatever that is, it's not as though you weren't there. Having to deal with this horrible, horrible book. So, I mean, Svea and I were there too, but we were students at UCLA. I mean,
you just had to read it.
No, we're being castigated and put outside the field because we weren't the right kinds of historians as this was going on.
And
so.
Those who took the seminar, you know, were the chosen ones. Yeah, they were chosen ones.
Yeah, I mean, I'll gossip now for a second. There was a really good cadre of graduate students from a number of fields working on really interesting postmodern thinkers, and not a single one of them were invited to the seminar to write the chapter about postmodernism and historians. So it was a sort of, we all knew, it was an open secret that this absurdity was going on.
Yeah.
So it, anyhow, that's a separate thing. So Carol also asked some really good questions. And one question is about why the latent ontology of the past.
Mm-hmm.
And so why do that? Well, so I think it is true that once you have a written history or a narrative, you've given a certain, now whether it's the actual past, is a thing. You've given a sort of an ontology to something you're writing about. You've given properties to it. Now, they're not the same kind of properties a table has. But in the sense that, let's say, we actually had, and this is where it's limited, we actually had the ruin of a boat or a document or a stela or a pot, we could say that those have properties in the present. And so we find them. And so, of course, we take what's latent and in a way we make it active. But it's entirely partial, it's again entangled, and it's problematic. And so what I'm trying to get at with this latent ontology is precisely to say that it isn't there in any kind of definite way, it's only activated at the hands of the historian who conjures it. And so I want it to be a very weak and problematic, this latent ontology. If it's an ontology, it's a latent ontology. And I guess that it's conditional as well.
I would lose it.
Yeah.
I would lose the ontology because I think it actually undoes your argument to some extent. Why does it have to be ontological, this reconstruction?
I don't think it does, but I would say that that's where it's, if it has one, the way to understand it is as activating properties of the past as if they're in the present. And I think that, I mean, I take your point, and it may be a question of trying to deploy an explanatory tool to be able to understand the way we make active as if it has properties in the present, things of the past. I mean, at least,
maybe it's an as if ontology,
yeah,
then, rather than a latent.
That may be true.
Maybe it's as if.
That may be true.
You know,
I mean, part of it has to do with whether, and this is something that I've had arguments with a number of philosophers about how hard you want to go with the question of whether we have ontological properties in the present. But I'll table that for a second. I do take that as a good and strong critique. The next question is about the dangers of a single story. And I think in some ways the dangers of a single story relate also to Steph's discussion of the multiple stories, of the perspectivalism, right? And I would like to think, or what I'm trying to argue is not for perspectivalism. It's not to say that there are different people from different standpoints taking a different approach. So it's not as though having two stories is better than one. or having seven stories is better than two. In fact, I think, and this goes back to that the double session, or a kind of multiplicity, each has to work and contest the other, so that the principles and properties of the telling are called into question and problematized. That allows for the deconstruction. And so the deconstruction traditionally works in binaries. I'd have to, you know, it'd be interesting to think about whether you could deploy, and I would like to think about it, deploying it in a more polysemic way. But in the working with the twos, it does allow one to demonstrate the relational properties in the way, even though they may appear oppositional, they one inhabits the other. And so I don't want it to be pure perspectivalism, and I don't want it to be as though having the two stories is going to solve it. I don't think that
so
would.
So the word, the critical word there, I see echoes, I see signs of it, but not, you never said it quite that strongly. You use the words like tension, but that each story has to contest the other, even as it inhabits in terms of its principle. That's very clear.
Okay.
Because that's the Levinas example.
Yes, right.
That's not just looking at it from the same.
No. So it has to the one has to unravel in a sense the other.
But it also has to share.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So those two things, the contestation and the partial sharing, if you like, mm-hmm. of the properties, that would
I mean, so that's,
that would answer my question.
Okay. Yeah. That's the aspiration. Call to the mat on the Eurocentrism. So I'll give a mea culpa. obviously, that's not the intention. The intention, and this comes out of conversations with historians who are not working in the American or European tradition, and mostly conversations I will say about temporality and about the problems of modern temporality that we all have, but the problems of assuming that temporality as a sort of a neutral and objective base, and the desire to allow for other understandings of temporality to be part of a historical narrative, or even what counts as history, and this would fit on the literature-history divide. So in several workshops with historians of and in Tibet and India, trying to understand the difference between allowing certain narratives and topographies to count with equal weight as history as those that are of what I guess you're referring to as the modern vernacular. That kind of contestation I think is productive, and that's what I'm trying to work at. And it may be in appropriating language of some critics of those who have criticized as Western, I've now entered into I'm not able to mobilize it in a way where I should be mobilizing something like modern, but that's obviously a helpful critique and allows me to be more aware of how to frame it. And actually that's a good way to frame it, because of course that puts it on the temporal regime of modern as mm-hmm. you've written about. Okay, so Steph. So I did talk a little bit about the perspectivalism. The ghost who lies, I mean, one thing is, I like ghosts. I mean, zombies, I don't mind zombies, but they're really here, you know? I mean, yeah, they're remnants, but zombies are here, you know? They stay here. The ghost I like more because it comes and it goes and it doesn't obey. I mean, the zombie still obeys certain rules.
Right, relentless, that's right.
I mean, it obeys certain rules. The ghost doesn't obey any rules. I mean, any of our rules. It has its own rules. And one of the great things about the ghost, like the past, is we really don't know if it's telling the truth. And we make a big mistake if we think, oh, we really, really, really should just believe it because it says that, right? And I think that is a mistake. The ghost is a tricky and liminal and problematic apparition. So I like it. Although I absolutely agree that moving into other sorts of monsters, hybrids, cyborgs, yes, those are all wonderful spaces to take and mobilize this sort of critique. I suppose it's precisely because I'm trying to work with and against Kosilek that the temporality issue leads me to want to focus on the ghost and the way the ghost problematizes that. In the end, Kosilek, I think, is most interesting when he's talking about temporality, but I'm actually not sure how interested Kosilek actually was in temporality. I think he's much more interested in methodology in the end, and it's just sort of a happy accident that to work out his methodology, he ended up writing a lot about problems of temporality to try to make it work. And so I think we run with and away from Kosilek when we do that, but I think that's the most productive place to go. Whether or not, he comes in and comes out. I didn't, it never occurred to me to take a sharp stick to Kosilek, but perhaps, certainly there are places and reasons why, not least of all, because his criticisms of the Middle Ages, in some ways, are simply a stand-in for criticisms of non-Western places, the ones who are outside of time, that aren't modern. And that's super problematic, so it probably is worth, really going forward with him. So, what else?
Freud.
Freud, of course, is haunting this book all throughout, right? There's no doubt about that. It's haunting Derrida, it's haunting Yerushalmi, it's haunting me. Freud has a great way, of course, in a way of walking around the problems of the past in the present. I think, it's not that I was actively avoiding Freud. I think it's that I probably would need to do some therapy to understand why Freud, who's such an obvious figure, isn't more prominent except for as a subject of analysis, right? I mean, there's something going on there. But Freud and repression do haunt the book. I don't exactly know what I would say, because I haven't thought systematically about it, except for really in relation to these other figures. And then moving into history of science, I'm just out of my depth, I would say. I don't know enough about the field, although I don't know why this wouldn't be appropriate. I don't see this as specific to concept history or intellectual history. I actually think it is a general criticism, and one that can be applied across myriad fields, and I think it's some of the most exciting epistemological work is being done in science studies and history of science. They're running away with it in many ways, but I guess I would turn to the last thing I'll say and then open it up, which has to do with the question of why truth? Why do we need truth? And actually, I did write a piece for Jones Journal, which was called Just the Facts, The Fantasy of an Historical Science, which is about the ways historians, for some reason, have always, or at least since, no, I would say always, but particularly since the 19th century, have felt they needed to justify themselves as a scientific discipline, as sciencey as science itself, to the point where they're completely out of sync with science's own realization that truth is something to be tested and overturned, and historians have maintained a notion of truth and truthiness more akin to a 19th century positivism than anything that scientists adhere to today. And it leads to all these sorts of cognitive dissonances. Again, probably the real answer to this would be to go back to Freud or maybe Heidegger and our relationship to death, and our need for truth to reify ourselves as a permanent and static subject that will always last in some way. Or if we won't last, at least we know there are things that will. This is truth, and I do talk a little bit about this, at least in Derrida's early lectures at the École Normale. He does do this series of courses on history and truth, where history, of course, is a problem because it's about change. Truth, which at that time he says is the property of philosophy, is about something that's permanent. And so in history, of course, you're always confronting death. We're dealing with ghosts, I would say, but we're dealing with dead objects. We're dealing with things that have passed away. And if you can somehow get truth into history, you solve the problem of death. Mm-hmm. But in doing so, you give up life. What you end up with are not living actors. You end up with statues or frozen moments of time that then you take to be a permanent present. And it's that permanent present that is precisely the target of the book. The historian somehow, I mean, methodologically, historians do this all the time. We look back and we say, oh, well, back then they believed this, but now we have these methods and these understandings, and so we have a much better way of doing it. But rather than saying, oh, well, we should be good historicists and say if we've decided that one isn't right, this one may change in ways in the future, we take our present to be this permanently enduring now that somehow is going to transport us all the way forward because we've cracked the methodological code. That's the mistake. And that's, I think, a lot of the obsession with truth. I think historians want to do well by the past, and they kind of have a moral sense of stewardship, but it leads them to these sorts of highly problematic statements. And I'll just leave it at that.
Close to half an hour. Yes, please.
Yeah, this was really interesting. Before reading it, I was struck by this description, at least that Joan gave, and you seemed to, it was referenced about your double reading of Levinas. And one of the things that struck me is that there didn't seem to be any strategy or approach that you were putting forward that would leave Levinas behind. You would never find other material that was more interesting. And so I was kind of also just wanted to ask about this question of, you know, again, just right now with method, you seem to reduce method to interpretation, to how one reads. And one of the ways that a lot of historians recently, like you've been trying in the aftermath of Joan and Dominic and these great discussions that I think still
people are all the class.
It still inspires so many that have been so productive for a lot of discussions. So when I think of people like more recently, like Laura Doan's work and other people trying to work with critical history, that have been focused on how we can methodologically find types of evidence in discussions that are unexpected. And it's not that we would then therefore read, and we would read with the type of approaches you have, but this attempt at how would we move outside of the already expected stories, that they would be methodological in terms of research strategies, in terms of being able to be exposed to types of individual voices rather than letting out at the same time, or stories or discussions that are not already always here in our discussion. So I just didn't see anything beyond reading strategies that you were offering. In kind of reduction of methodology to interpretation, rather than the fact that historians, you know, is like I also work besides with Joan with Bonnie Smith and the idea that there are certain practices that define how historians recognize each other that are not reducible to Novick's debate between a ridiculous limited debate between relativism and objectivism. I mean, so where's the methodological, and again, like Stefanos was asking you about, where else would we, you know, kind of give us an example of the type of research strategy that we would allow us to think through? Is it all just about reading? And so we should all be going to Levinas and Derrida and rereading them again and again in different ways because they have methods of reading that we should learn from, or can we also do other types of research projects with that?
Yeah,
I can see how we would read in ways that you suggest.
Sure.
I don't understand how we would get the material. Because again, you said how we would deploy our material, how we would read our material. Mm-hmm. What about the material itself?
So I mean, that's a great question. And I think it is in some ways, I would hope, a function of our discussion that we although, you know, the examples I give are work within my vernacular, which is intellectual history. And I do recognize that. But I would say, I mean, actually, I hate the term methodology, actually, because I don't like the metahodos, right? You know, I want poros, so I got to figure out a metaporos strategy where you're because the thing that I don't want to do, what I think methodology does is it sort of tells you where to look and what to look at, and what I'm trying to advocate for is an attunement to looking in the unexpected places or listening to those things which haven't been heard. And I don't think that's necessary. I mean, it can be a reading strategy, but it's a looking strategy and it's a searching strategy. And that's where this play of presence and absence also is. You could imagine in the archaeology, not simply looking for those things that are there, but trying to be aware of those things that are missing, and trying to, and of course that's a hard strategy, right? Because in looking for absences, you know, that most of the past is absent, as it turns out. We only have slivers. But sometimes absences are, that's when they haunt us, is when actually we can find them. Things that you realize sort of, it's peculiar that there's a missing here, that's an absence here, that there's an omission here. This is it hasn't been taken as evidence, that hasn't been accepted as something that's valuable. I think that works in all sorts of material ways, that we can, if I use the term reread many artifacts, or maybe latency is a good term, to reactivate artifacts that simply hadn't been coded as signifying in any kind of way. So whether this is through archaeological evidence, whether it's actually, you know, this Steph asked why literature. Actually, I think literature is much more attuned to the way the past haunts us than historians ever were. And historians should be better trained at reading literature, not literature so they can use it because it's a fact and can prove something for them. In fact, in some ways, because it doesn't have that burden, and you can find voices and spaces. Again, with literature, that's reading, but you can imagine it with artifacts of art or culture or song. I mean, there's a lot of places one could look. One certainly should look to work that other disciplines are doing and what they value. So I don't think it's only sort of an intellectual history strategy, although I can understand, because that's what I work on, why one would take that approach. But I believe it's much broader and can be applied in a much more robust way. It requires a kind of reactivation of imagination.
But also, it seems to me a political impetus.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what Todd is actually asking.
Yeah.
How I think of, you know, the work that you've done, which is that it's not simply looking for something that hasn't been looked at, but the reason for looking has everything to do with the history of the present.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that's where the sort of Foucauldian, the critical Foucauldian political impetus seems to me to come into how those things get identified, or what it is that you start looking for that you haven't seen before.
Yeah, well, the danger, of course, is that, you know, it's not as though any one person or group has the moral imperative of the political. And so
right.
It can be used in all sorts of ways.
That's right.
And that's the beauty and the danger, right?
That's
politics.
Yeah.
But I would say, I mean, I don't think this applies only to intellectual history. I just think that's what you do.
Yeah.
But I actually think that this business of looking, you know, asking a different question, well, if you want to put it in really, you know, plain, ordinary language, you're actually asking, you're saying, don't look at what everybody says and walk down that same causeway, ask a different question. That's a very ordinary language way of saying you're going to see some of the missing and the absences. Mm-hmm. That can be in any domain. I mean, I think part of it is the sheepiness, you know, the whatever you want to call it. I mean, the fact that the way the disciplines and the way the way the intellectual history of knowledge keeps people on the path. I mean, that's the sheep part or the lemming part. It's not lemmings, because they're just sheep. Lemmings actually, lemmings are fast. They go all over the place.
Historians are cautious. They probably wouldn't go over the edge, would they? They'd all stop.
But I encourage you to say that you can do this. You might change the language a little bit, but it still works with the absences, with the contestation, with the, you know, the shared logics. You know, I think it would be, you could do it of anything.
I agree on that, but I'm still curious. I wonder if I can invert Todd's question and say, did you teach something recently where you just thought, like, wow, here I see things that...
That's what you want to know,
yeah. Yeah, in a certain sense, a kind of example. Like, was there a book where you really just thought, wow, this is what I would have done differently? I know that I'm just asking...
You mean a book
the kind of
that
most obnoxious question
sort
possible.
Of strategy?
No. Where you would just say...
Oh, when I read a book.
Yes, I thought... A book where you really just, as you read it through, where you were thinking, wow, there really aren't any, you know, present absences here. And...
Well, I mean...
And that... No, but some, like, particularly glaring example that would...
A bad example, you're saying. what you're saying.
No.
Yes.
Oh, a bad example.
I'm taunting him too.
You want a bad example. I want a good example.
A historian.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I see this.
Come on.
I mean, I'll say it. I feel bad doing this, but why should I? Right? If you read, for instance, Dan Smale's recent books, using the neurological model.
Yeah, yeah, I wonder. You have. I'd like to hear you say that because you put neuroscience in that list of awfuls. You know, with the
materials. Well, it doesn't have to be. I mean,
what you mean.
So if you look in that, it actually there's this weird mechanism at play where what has to happen to understand, say, medieval actors is a transposition of research done in the 21st century. That on, you know, the way brains work, and then you have to assume that brains work exactly the same way in, I don't know, 1500 Castile, in order to be able to make the causal link as to why people act this way, mm-hmm. which is completely antithetical to the argument in the book that our brains change based on cultural
and environmental
works. And now, what ends up happening there is it's all about presences. Right, in that book, everything is about activating these presences. In fact, even the actors that he decides to look at are the ones where you have these presences. And it ends up being a very interesting, I guess, kind of positivistic causal explanation that is completely in tension with itself. And it'd actually be a much more interesting work if you were to problematize on either side, you know, what he has is present with those things that are absent, and even, and here's where you could get an interesting deconstruction, this logic of historical dynamism that he wants to be the basis of the narrative with this other logic of absolute stasis, where the brain's
the same.
Has to be the same. I mean, you could do some really interesting things with the evidence that he has. It's really interesting evidence. I don't know if I buy it, because I would have to figure out how they do these algorithms to decide what the brain means and then translating the data into pictures. But let's leave that aside. With the evidence he has, you could actually construct a pretty interesting and problematic history that would be a history of the present, because it would tell you about violence in Castile in the 1600s, and it would tell you about what we think the brain does in the 21st century.
But that's a good example. That's a good example of your ontological realist, is because he's trying to do the exact opposite. I mean, he's giving you a new story that he thinks is the story.
Yeah.
So he's not open to that kind of problematizing.
No, and he reverse engineers it, so he can figure out exactly what happened. So, but of course, it's from a position of the present that he's able to tell us what happened in the past, and then that dictates how it's true than what he knows in the present. And it's
tough. But I think that. An answer to Stefanos' question about is deconstruction restricted to conceptual topics, I would ask it differently. I would say it is, but not. I would not use the word restricted. It is about conceptual topics because the assumption is that what you're looking at is language, and what language is the way of understanding the world and organizing your perceptions of the world. So it's not that it's purely intellectual history, but it's certainly to the extent that language is the name of the game, and that language conceptualizes reality. It is about that, and I mean I've had graduate students, you know, who wanted to study something, and my response would be no. It's not the event that you want to study, but the way people conceive of what it is they're doing, and in some ways that gets you out of the ontological realism.
That's right.
You go to language which is what Derrida does, mm-hmm. as the key to reality, and language is slippery and, mm-hmm. and you know always in conflict.
You don't have to worry about whether it's ontologically latently ontological or really ontological. I agree.
I mean, then you get Barthes and the reality mm-hmm. effect, you know, right?
So I completely agree. What happened, and then the problem about ontology comes right back, right? That then, in a way, if it's all, in a sense, about webs and constellations of concepts, linguistic formations, and so on, with which I completely agree.
It's not only all about. It's that the key to the French Revolution, or World War I, or whatever, you can't get there without going through language. It's not that you're giving up on events or real things. I don't know how to put it.
No, I'm entirely with you. I'm entirely, entirely with you. My point was rather, why would we call... Why would you still use terminology of ontology in that case? That's the part of it. Like,
because
I get
that's
it.
What he's objecting to.
Well, it's ontology. It's this notion that there is that ontology is about the real is what I'm objecting to. I don't actually think that's what ontology is or how it works. I think I'm much more aligned with Derrida in that if ontology is anything, it's about sort of an is surature. You know, it's not. It's always a problematic. Understanding of unstable and even in some ways non-commensurate self. That's what ontology is, although actually in this case I'd do it like that.
Yes.
And so if I say it has a latent ontology, I'm trying to put that in context, and this I guess is something that doesn't come out, but in my mind this is how it fits. When I talk about ontological realism, that's a mistake, because I don't think that's what ontology is. Ontology is not
that. You're using it critically.
Yeah, and so when I talk about a latent ontology, it's a different, I would say it's a different attempt to deploy ontology that coincides exactly with this is that's Bappe, you know, that we can't have or get to in the way that you would if it was this simply ontologically real past as it actually really happened. So that's what I'm trying to do, but I can see where it needs to be. The ontology needs to be more consistently problematized all the way through, which in some ways that was the goal of the is, which is the ultimate ontological word.
Right.
But I can see why it would appear like I'm coming in on one side and on the other with the ontological.
So what you want to do is actually find the way, maybe latent isn't the right word, to find the right word with ontology that actually expresses the bar. I mean, expresses the is with the bar, which latent ontology doesn't.
It should have been an H. You don't even need latent, but ontology.
Right.
It's latent by definition.
Yeah. Can I ask an off the wall question?
There's only been one question from the audience.
Yes, please.
I feel like this ontological debate, I don't know if I can like really get in there with this particular question, but to come back to the question of maybe how this can be applied in practice for historians, I'm wondering about two kind of possible ways that this has been happening or could happen, and one is memory and memory studies, and the other is trauma, especially the kind of contemporary debate about intergenerational trauma, which for me and my kind of cohort is both a social justice question, right, and a methodological question. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on either of those two.
So I think trauma is actually one of the places where haunting is most apparent. I do think that is a not only an apt site, but probably in some ways the lowest hanging fruit, because the trauma does imply, right, the welling up. The harder places are where something traumatic happened, but of course we don't have any of the remaining symptoms of trauma because of a total erasure or effacement or repression. But trauma is the place to look, and trauma manifests in lots of ways, so you don't always look for the obvious symptoms. But I would say, you know, that's right. Memory I find more problematic because, you know, I think one has to be very careful in distinguishing history and memory, and even collective memory, precisely because of this problem of experience, right? So it seems, in some cases, memory is afforded a certain kind of privileged status because it's related to experience and then thus is considered more real. So I really would want to bring this kind of deconstructive approach as a critical apparatus to memory, where you're not discounting it, which I think is the mistake that, you know, some historians do when they're criticizing when they go at memory studies, but you're also not privileging it in this way that somehow there's something more real about having been the person who remembered it. And collective memory is also a strange beast, because depending on whether you're sort of Humean in your understanding of memory, right, where then you'd have to actually be the person who experienced, or you have a more Platonic notion of memory as some sort of well that we all have access to, it comes out quite differently. And I don't think historians have spent a lot of time thinking about those different ways that memory might be at work. Rather, they just run to Halvox and sort of try and get out from there. So I I think that's where I think actually the deconstruction can get at some of these internal inconsistencies and problems within the notion of how memory works on the singular and the collective, and might be an interesting way to approach it. So I think that both I think absolutely appropriate fields. Memory in some ways more vexing to me, but I mean, it's just I'm vexed.
Final question. I'm still stuck on this question of the examples. Mm-hmm. of it, and I was trying to think of, I mean, if we were having such a hard time locating an example of history that you would call deconstructive, but there's obviously examples in literary criticism mm-hmm. that I think are doing what you're calling for. I'm thinking of someone like Paul de Man or, mm-hmm. or someone like Barbara Johnson, for example. But and so I guess I want to ask you, you know, what if, are all texts, going back to Todd's questions, like, are all texts potentially deconstructible, right? And then I kind of want to ask you the question that probably Dominic LaCapra would ask you if he were here, you know, is like, are you going to deconstruct the texts of the, you know, the Nazi writings of, or the journalistic writings of Paul de Man in the same way that you would deconstruct, you know, Rousseau?
Mm-hmm.
The explicit, so, are some texts that are, what do you do with highly symptomatic texts, say, like a, you know, Nazi propaganda mm-hmm. or something like that? How would you... Would you be able to do that same resistance to closure
with those texts?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I would say, I mean, I think the past is, I mean, so this relation between past and our trying to activate the past in whatever way we activate it, that is, to my mind, always open to a deconstructive approach. I think actually
deconstructive reading, I'm saying, you know.
Well,
how do you read deconstructively something like Mein Kampf?
Why is that? I don't see why that's a problem. Because you don't like it?
No, not because I don't like it.
And
because
it's politically
because
bad.
No, because whatever. No, it's not because it's political. But that's one example. But it's for example, like because I'm talking about the Paul de Man text because there has been an attempt
right.
to read
mm-hmm.
those deconstructively,
right.
and the result is just not. I mean, it's like really. It seems really far fetched from what the it just doesn't seem like. It's not because it's politically objectionable. It's more because the reading doesn't seem to stand.
Well, so I think the problem with that. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Is that yes? It's been read. It was read deconstructively by Derrida himself.
Yeah.
It was not read historically.
Mm-hmm.
It was not read historically at all. And so, I mean, I think when you move into a mode where then it's a rhetorical exercise. And you know, someday if I have the time and the will, I'm going to write a piece called "Running Away with Literature," which will be about Hayden White and Derrida and how I think. When they landed in and were received so well in literature departments, they each sort of gave up on history for a while.
Right.
I think what would need to happen with a text like that is, for the historian, is precisely that you need to place it in relation both to its context and to other texts. I mean, you know, an interesting deconstructive history of the Nazi past might be one that actually takes Alltagsgeschichte very seriously and places, you know, what is a narrative of particular people in a particular place, but it can't just be left, you know, to allow East Germans to be victims in Dresden. It has to be one that then is placed in this other oppositional or tension
yeah.
of a larger narrative that actually sees what's at stake, say, in Europe or for the Jews, or however you want to frame it, that then allows those two to actually force a contestation between the two. And if Mein Kampf came into that, or if Paul de Man came into that, I think that it absolutely would be available for that sort of work. So I don't think there's anything that's taboo. I don't worry about... it's dangerous because it does allow itself to say, well... There's nothing wrong with this historical account, qua historical account of the East Germans as victims. The problem is, of course, that it doesn't take account of all of this other historical information that's part of the story. And so to allow them to work at odds and with each other, I think actually does more service for the historian and the reader.
You sound much more like a traditional historian when you speak like that.
Exactly.
Like
maybe.
Like
when you say
we should read historically rather than deconstructively, isn't that kind of...
No.
You do books.
Yes.
Right. I mean,
the historian should be first and foremost a deconstructionist, if one can say that. That when you're, so I think the problem with the De Man reading is that
the
it,
double session, that was
yeah, that, well, that's the, it. The De Man session, is, the, Derrida's reading of De Man is not in any way a double session. I don't think. It's a very strange...
It's apologetic. It's not.
It's
not.
Yeah, it's a sort
it's
of
apologetic.
Present of friendship, the gift of friendship.
Yes.
Well,
yeah,
rather than a real reading.
It's a, in that sense, an apology.
It's many things. But again, so if I would... So what I would say is, yeah, as with any deconstruction, you work within the limits of the structure to destabilize the structure. So in this case, it's the discipline of history. You are working within the discipline of history. What does he say? To make it tremble, right? To solliciter, to actually shake its foundations. But you have to work through it to actually precisely show the way, to strain its logic, to show its limitations, to show its problems. But you so the very approach.
Just out of curiosity, why are we bound to the discipline? Just because?
Well, I think it would unbind us. Actually, I don't know that we necessarily need to be, but I think it would unbind us to be able to do that. But in some ways, so I guess this would be on the critical side, and maybe so. That's a good point. Maybe on the critical side, you're working within to show its limits, but actually, when you go to write it, you're then unfettered precisely because you've seen that. I'm sort of standing on one foot. I'm trying to write a case study of what it is to do a deconstructive history in the case of Levinas, even as we speak, trying to make these things work. Now, that makes my mind within a world of texts and a sort of intellectual history and problems of secularism and religion. But it also makes me say, I think it's viable, and I think it can be done, and I think it does precisely not only inhabit the discipline, but tells you don't need to stay in it. I mean, the whole second session is completely outside. It's completely outside, although it shows that much of what's in the discipline is already there in the outside.
Why is it completely? Why is the second session on the religion completely outside?
Well, it's outside of what our claims are in the discipline about secularity.
But it's so funny. That's how I understood you, that you're abandoning all of that. But then when you, in response to Camille, say we need to put things in context and so on. Then I'm
but that Derrida says that too.
Yeah, okay, but you know, it's about you.
But
you're not putting them in context and leaving them there. You're saying this is how the context has been understood. And as you described your Levinas, your double session with Levinas, the first one is, here's how Levinas has been written about, here's how intellectual historians have understood him, here's how he's understood as a sort of secular, a voice of secular philosophy. And then, second session, we go read Levinas and find out that he's full of religious kind of transcendental kind of... So the second reading is critically opening up and disrupting the first one.
No one understands that.
That's the context part, right?
I must stop there. I truly apologize. But I want to capture this moment by final word on Ghosts and History. So in Half a Man is a Woman, the great Chinese novelist Zhang Xianliang tells us what happens to him in the Cultural Revolution. And there's a moment where the protagonist, who is a communist poet, is beaten to death, destroyed, and thrown into some place in northern China into exile. And he sits by a tree, doesn't understand what's going on, and he starts crying. And then the ghost of one of his ancestors, a very important official from the Sung Dynasty 1,000 years before, appears and says, "Why are you crying like a crybaby? What's going on?" And Zhang Xianliang says, "I can't understand the times I'm living in." And the angry official says, "Well, you live in the Xuanhe period, the period of great misery, of chaos, and disorder." And he refers to a period that happened 1,000 years before. So Zhang Xianliang thinks about it for a second, and he tells the ghost of his ancestor, says, "Well, is that supposed to calm me down?" Thank you very much. For